introduce our.
Mrs. Geneva Dalton was born and raised in Grafton, West Virginia, and became a United Methodist at a very early age of 13. She graduated from Grafton High School and was awarded a four-year scholarship to attend college. She graduated with honors from Fairmount College in 1977 after having given birth to three children. She entered the graduate program for social workers in 1977 at West Virginia University and received a Master's of Social Work degree in 1979. Her employment has been diverse. She has served as a remedial education teacher for the West Virginia State Department of Corrections, a supervisor for operators at the CNP Telephone Company, a director and counselor for the Odyssey Group Home for Girls in Morgantown, West Virginia, and executive director for Family Service Association in Morgantown. In March of 1984, Geneva was elected as a member of the General Secretariat of the Commission on the Status and Role of Women, that position she is presently in. Geneva has served as a chairperson for the annual conference Commission on Religion and Race in West Virginia, and for a short time as a member of the General Commission on Religion and Race. She also held positions on the Council on Ministries, the Ethnic Minority Local Church Task Force, that's the annual conference on ministries, the Black Ministries Task Force, and the Black Ministers Recruitment Task Force. She served as a part-time lay campus minister for Black students at West Virginia University, as a part of programming from the West Virginia Annual Conference Board of Higher Education and Ministry. She designed and delivered workshops on racism for local churches and districts, and she held training workshops for the district and local church religion and race directors. She has done a tremendous lot, an awful lot for such a young and beautiful woman. She has been an active member of the Black Methodists for Church Renewal since 1979. In 1982, Geneva was selected as a participant of a team to teach stewardship skills to United Methodist pastors in Liberia, West Africa. This program was sponsored by the General Board of Global Ministries. She attended the United Nations Decade of Women Forum in Nairobi, Kenya in July of 85 as a continuing education event. It gives me great pleasure to present to you Mrs. Geneva Dalton. We're going to sing first.
Thank you, Janet. I looked at the paper that she was going to read from and had no idea that all of that was there. It seemed to take her an awful long time to get through all of it. I love BMCR. And I can't tell you how happy I am to be here and how proud I feel and how humble I feel that I've been asked to speak here. I can remember in 1979 when I first came to BMCR, and I was so impressed with the woman who was speaking for the women's luncheon. Her name is Leontine Kelly. She has been for me and is for me one of the connecting links in my life. I see others, And I just want to take a minute to acknowledge them and to say thank you to these black women who are connectors to the black community for me and for many of you. I see Thelma Barnes. Thank you, Thelma. And I see Betty Henderson. Thank you, Betty. And I see my friends from West Virginia, Charlotte and Kim and Helen. Thank you. And thanks to all of you for being the community that I need. And thank you for allowing me to be a part of that community and for having the opportunity to be of service to you. There's another woman whose name was also Geneva, who lived once. She's departed this life now, 3 years ago. But I want to recognize and acknowledge that for me, she was my mother. She was the most powerful link to the black church and the black community and to the Christian faith that I will ever have. She used to sing a song to me as she rocked me as a little girl. I didn't understand the words then as I do now, but I recognized the melody. And somehow I always felt a certain comfort and strength as she sang these words in that familiar melody. As she sang, "Jesus, Savior, pilot me over life's tempestuous sea, unknown waves before us roll, hiding rocks and treacherous shoal. Chart and compass come from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me." As a mother stills her child, thou can hush the ocean wild. Boisterous waves obey thy will when thou sayest to them, "Be still." Wondrous sovereign of the sea, Jesus, Savior, pilot me. When at last I near the shore and the fearful breakers roar, 'twixt me and peaceful rest, then while leaning on thy breast, may I hear thou say to me, "Fear not, I will pilot thee." On reflecting on the suggested theme for my presentation today, the black woman, the connecting link, a specific image came to my mind. Women, literally, as connecting links. Black women with hands connected to form a chain or a circle, connected to one another and through us to the black community. Women, all of whom are daughters, and some of whom are mothers. Young women, senior women, healthy women and infirm women, educated and uneducated women, Christian women and agnostic women. And interspersed in the links of my imaginary human chain are black men, young men, and senior men, handsome men and homely men, educated and uneducated men, sick men and healthy men, and another man whose color and gender and to whom color and gender is insignificant, Jesus Christ. Black women and men connecting the black community to the grace and goodness and strength of our blessed Redeemer, Jesus Christ. The Women's Concerns Committee has selected as its mission statement Psalms 2, verse 7. And it says to us, I will declare the decree. The Lord hath said to me, thou art my daughter. This day have I begotten thee. How appropriate and how necessary that Jesus is a part of our connection. I found myself on a personal journey. I relived parts of my life as a young girl, as a daughter, as a girlfriend, a wife, a mother, a divorcee, a teacher, a church worker. The journey then took a different turn to imagine the road traveled by my mother and my grandmother and their mothers and their grandmothers. And then the already familiar realization. My way of being in the world is directly and intentionally affected by those foremothers and forefathers who have been connecting links. Likewise, my children will and are reflecting the same values, motives, and lifestyles they have been taught. Very surely, we are connecting links. Sometimes I find that my daughter, who is nearly 16 years old, is not only her mother's student, but her teacher as well. A connection to a past that she has not experienced, but one that she remembers through me and through her grandparents. That memory is evident in a poem she wrote when she was 13 years old, and she entitled it Granny's Sunlight. Wondrous windows with light streaming in tell of our vices, our love, and our sin. Dark, brown, and deep, telling stories untold, tales from the darkness and the jungle unfold. Recalled from our history, heard with surprise, you can see the bright sunlight in a black woman's eyes. Like my granny who worked in a hot field all day, just a-picking that cotton, not a word did she say. She did as they told her. Come rain or come shine, she dried white women's clothes upon a clothesline. Now she didn't like it, but she wouldn't complain. My granny had faith that all wasn't in vain. She'd always been strong. But one night she cried when my big, strong, dark grandpa from a white bullet died. For the most part unshaken, she stayed strong for me. Using no words to say it, she hoped I could see my people's hard stories, our moans and our sighs. And that sunlight was left in all black women's eyes. How poignantly important it is for us to share the stories of our past with our children. Someone once said, a history not remembered will repeat itself. I know also how important it is to have some of history repeat itself. Think for a moment about how our lives and self-images would be altered if we did not remember Sojourner Truth, or Harriet Tubman, or Mary McLeod Bethune, or the senior women of our local churches whom we fondly refer to as Mama or Grandma. Think of the profound effect their lives have had on our own. How many young women will include us when they reflect on the connecting links in their lives? Are we talking right? Are we setting examples that they can follow that will strengthen the Black family and the Black community? The Black family is a matter of serious and disturbing conversation recently. We're experiencing some of the following situations. Black children, when compared to white children, are twice as likely to be born prematurely, to have mothers who received little or no prenatal care, to be born to a teenaged or an unmarried parent, three times as likely to be poor, to have mothers who die in childbirth, to live with a parent who is separated from the other parent, to be murdered between 5 and 9 years of age, four times as likely to be murdered before 1 year of age or as a teenager, to be placed in an educable, mentally retarded class, 11 times as likely to live with a parent who has never married. Fathers are walking away from their families at alarming rates due to unemployment, rigid welfare regulations, or of not realizing and accepting the awesome responsibility of fatherhood and the neediness and dependency of children beyond economic neediness. Unemployment has caused poverty to engulf Black families that were already just barely managing. Black unemployment is at least twice as high as that of whites. Automation and industrialization have forced Black workers who were not vocationally prepared to the unemployment lines. Factories are moving from the mainland United States to places abroad where cheaper labor can be found. Could it be that our nation's industries, finding its minority problem too costly, simply move away to manufacture new minorities? In the past, Black families could often make it because of a second job. That is, cleaning doctor's offices, selling vegetables or jewelry, or anything to make an extra dollar. Today, competition is too keen for every job, no matter how minor. Because the Black family is being eroded by economic and social problems, the crime syndicate is exploiting Blacks with the availability of illegal drugs. Many young people are accepting the offer to make a fast buck by selling drugs and are consequently using drugs. No one is forcing people to swallow drugs or to inject them into their bodies. That is coming from low self-esteem and personal weaknesses in a society where there is no apparent support. Societal problems such as racism and sexism and unemployment and the inadequacy of the educational system, particularly for Black males, are also responsible for the unstable status of many male-female relationships. How can we maintain or establish a strong family background if we cannot respect one another as women and men? If we cannot look beyond ourselves toward a larger common goal, the Black family and its perpetuation? Dr. Joyce Ladner, a sociologist at Howard University School of Social Work, says, We must recognize that black men and women are not the problem. There are certainly enough real enemies without finding enemies within. We cannot continue to use one another as scapegoats. We must remember as well that the solutions often applied to white female-male relationships are inappropriate for black women and men. We must interpret the problems of black male and female relationships in the framework of our own black tradition, remembering that white couples' relationships are not affected by racism. Black women fulfill multiple roles in their lives and in their work. At which points are we connectors? Are there places in which we can drop our hands and let someone else pick up the ends of our human chain? I think not. For to do so allows the destructive elements of our society to creep in and to destroy that which we have for centuries guarded and nourished and by the grace of God been able to preserve. The black community and the black church is only as strong as its individual members. An old African proverb asserts, rain does not fall on one roof alone. Those evils that assail each of us assail us all. Black women have been taught to assume the monumental responsibility for the entire black community. And we actually attempt to live out that responsibility. This was discovered in a study done by Gloria Joseph, professor in the School of Social Sciences at Hampshire College. Gloria did a nationwide survey of black women in 1979 and 1980. To in part determine how the impact of black motherhood on black women differs from the influence of white motherhood on white women. What was surprisingly evident in the results of the study was the teaching of survival skills to black females for their survival in and for the survival of the black community. Black daughters are actually taught to hold the black community together. These attitudes and teachings become internalized and are transmitted to future generations. I want to share more of the study with you because as I read it, I was struck by how similar were the teachings of my own mother and grandmother to those of women today. We are taught to have courage, strength, to be caring, to be good mothers, to persevere, and to make sacrifices. African women, when they are hungry, say, "Roast something so that the children may eat." Sound familiar? Black mothers also teach their daughters to be fiercely independent of others. Repeatedly, the women in the survey gave the following responses to the questions related to what our mothers taught us about life. Be independent and as financially independent as you possibly can. Get an education. Have self-respect or no one else will respect you. It takes two to make a marriage successful. The daughters manifest these teachings as is shown by their response to the question, the best way to get ahead is, 87.5% of the daughters felt that the best way to get ahead was through their own efforts and through education or both.
So we're taught to be nurturers of others, but not to be and to be independent and to expect no nurturing in return. There are also patterns and similarities in what we teach to and how we socialize our sons to exist in a racist society. It has long been recognized that black males are especially targeted for brutalization, humiliation, incarceration, lynching. They have to be taught safe ways of existing in a white society. Black males are taught survival skills. We say, see but don't see. Be aware of what's going on around you, but don't leer, especially at white women. Know, but don't tell everything. We black mothers and daughters know well the consequences of being black in America. We've always been subject to negative labels and stereotypes which symbolize the powerlessness and victimized states we hold in society. This is not just true for men. It is doubly true for women who are black. Racism is the load we carry together as women and men. Sexism is the load women bear in the black and the white community by ourselves, or so it sometimes seems. We will talk about this later. But any discussion of black mother-child relationships would be incomplete without mention of those mannerisms that mothers so often use to teach and to control and to instill healthy fear and respect in their children. These mannerisms are learned without formal instruction and without even being aware that learning is taking place. These include that particular facial expression. The smirk, and a certain way of standing or sitting. The way she holds her mouth, as well as cooking secrets, and how to keep babies well without the help of Dr. Spock. All are a part of our learning to be and serving as connecting links in our community. Sometimes we laugh to keep from crying, and sometimes we laugh to keep from dying. We learn to say baby with at least 9 different intonations or inflections. And each one carries a different message. It can mean friendship, patience, love, affection, sarcasm, compassion, empathy, derogation, or flirtation. Another important theme is the implication of the black mother and daughter teachings about marriage. I found it interesting that in the study, 77% of the respondents said that mother gave negative information about men, such as don't trust any man. But 67% of black mothers still recommend marriage. Women, what does this say about us? We follow a formula which ensures our centrality in the black world. A breakdown of the formula reads, Black society needs a Black community, which requires Black families, which involves parents, which implies marriage, which means woman becomes legal partner to man. And we've been faithfully following this formula for generations, with variations as necessary. For instance, parents in our society and community are not always mother or father, but sometimes other. That is, aunt, uncle, grandma, grandpa, sisters, or brother can serve as parents. Children are not always naturally born to us, but sometimes our nieces and cousins, sisters and brothers, and so on. Our families are extended beyond our nuclear families to include every blood relative, and in some instances, those where there are no blood ties. This discussion by no means indicates that Black men have not been productive or that they have not been a part of the connection. Black men are recognized for their leadership qualities in family life and in the community. And Black men will be the first to revere Black women for their roles as connecting links. Take, for instance, the Black ritualization of Mother's Day. How important it's always been to make this an extra special day of remembering Mama. In our large families, whole pews of churches are filled on Mother's Day Sunday with children, young and old, men and women wearing the red or the white carnation. There are flowers on the altar. There are flowers delivered at home, at work, in the hospital. The walls of the home place reveal the Mother's Day offering of grandchildren and children. And if you look in the china closets and the bureaus, Mother's Day cards of years gone by will be found in there. Mother's Day is a nationwide observance, not limited to Black families. But the style and manner and enthusiasm and the reverence for mothers has its root in our African past. Curiously, when white women in the study were discussing what person, or were asked the question, what person was most influential in your life, the majority did not say mother. Rather, mother was the person named as the one I'm most fearful of being like. And now a word about the dilemma that we as Black women are facing. I alluded earlier that Black women are seemingly facing the issues of sexism alone in the Black community. We affirmed and appraised the role of Black women as connecting links in the Black community, the Black church, and the Black society. Since the early 60s, when the women's movement gained momentum, Black women have been struggling with where and how and if the issues of the feminist movement are relevant to or constructive in the life of the Black family and the community. For sure, there are commonalities in the ways in which sexism in the society at large touches us in destructive ways, as it does white women. And around these issues, we must join forces with our white sisters for the good of us all. And there are ways in which our perspectives and our approach to feminism is drastically different. To paraphrase the words of Dr. Dolores Williams in her article entitled The Color of Feminism, White women define the oppressor of women as patriarchy. Black women suffer from patriarchy as well, but we're not able to stop there. White women also benefit from patriarchy and therefore become a part of the oppression of black women and men. To explain more fully, Dr. Williams asserts that white American patriarchy in its institutional manifestations affords many white female children and white female adults the care, protection, and resources necessary for intellectual development and physical well-being. Therefore, white American patriarchy has provided white women with the education, skills, and support they need to get first chance at the opportunities for women resulting from the pressures of the civil rights movement in America. White American patriarchy also intends to support the life and physical growth, intellectual development, and economic well-being of the female and male fruit of the white woman's womb when that fruit issues from her sexual union with white males. From a black female perspective, then, it is possible to speak of the productive patriarchal content of white patriarchy for white women and her children. However, the same institutions have no such productive intent for black women or the fruit of our wombs. Rather, these institutions intend the retardation of the intellectual, emotional, spiritual, economic, and physical growth of black women and our children, male or female. Therefore, the feminist understanding of the patriarchal relationship between women and society's institutions does not include black women's oppression resulting from their relation to white male and female controlled American institutions governing our lives. We as a black community cannot use words that only identify men as oppressors of women. We must have nomenclature which identifies white society, both male and female, as the oppressor to effectively describe our reality. Dolores Williams states that, inasmuch as Afro-American women's history shows that black women have struggled simultaneously for their own liberation and that of other black people, males, females, and children, it is appropriate to suggest that a woman's movement would have at least three primary goals, and certainly we can have these in the United Methodist Church: liberation of women and the family simultaneously. Number two, establishing a positive quality of life for women and the family simultaneously. And number three, forming political alliances with other marginal groups struggling to be free of the oppressions imposed by white-controlled American institutions. Finally, we as Black United Methodists must not allow the racism and the sexism we encounter to deter us from political and social involvement with the issues. The women and men of the black community are makers of blueprints. We can make another one. In 1882, Anna Cooper, a black woman, proudly voiced the black woman's perspective on feminism in a speech that she gave to Congress. She said, "Let women's claim be as broad in the concrete as in the abstract. We take our stand on the solidarity of humanity, the oneness of life, and the unnaturalness and injustice of all special favoritism, whether of sex, race, country, or condition. If one link in the chain is broken, the entire chain is broken. A bridge is no stronger than its weakest part, and a cause is no worthier than its weakest element. Least of all can women's cause afford to decry the weak. We want then, as toilers for the triumph of justice and human rights, to go to our homes from this Congress demanding an entrance not through a gateway for ourselves, our race, our sex, but a grand highway for humanity. Amen. The black woman feels that women's cause is one and universal, and that not till the image of God, whether in white or black, male or female, is sacred, not till race, color, sex, and condition are seen as accidents and not the substance of life, not till the entitlement of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is conceded to all, not till then is women's cause won, not the black woman's, not the white woman's, not the red woman's." The cause of every person who has suffered under a mighty wrong. Let us continue to form the human chain of connectedness to one another as sisters and brothers under God. And let us remember that we are God's men and women, and that our time under God is now. Let us not be so discouraged by the signs of the times or so burdened by the weights of the world that we forget for whom we carry the crosses. You know, one of our old spirituals says to us that if we can't bear no crosses, we can't wear no crowns. I'd like to have both. Frances Ellen Watkins Hayes carried the cross of racism and sexism in her day of 1854. She wrote about it and entitled the poem, "Bury Me in a Free Land." Make me a grave wherever you will, in a lowly plain or a lofty hill, and make it among earth's humblest graves, but not in a land where people are slaves. I couldn't rest if around my grave I heard the steps of a trembling slave. Her shadow above my silent tomb would make it a place of fearful gloom. I couldn't rest if I heard the tread of a coffle gang to the stables led, and the mother's shriek of wild despair rise like a curse on the trembling air. I couldn't sleep if I saw the lash drinking her blood at each fearful gash, and I saw her babes torn from her breast like trembling doves from their parents' nest. I'd shudder and start if I heard the bay of bloodhounds seizing their human prey, if I heard the captive plead in vain as they bound afresh his galling chain, if I saw young girls from their mother's arms bartered and sold for their youthful charms, My eye would flash with a mournful flame, my death-pale cheek grow red with shame. I would sleep, dear friends, where bloated might can rob no person's dearest right. My rest shall be calm in any grave, where none can call another a slave. I ask no monument, proud or high, to arrest the gaze of the passers-by. All that my yearning spirit craves is bury me not in a land of slaves. Let us listen to the voices of those who have gone before us and those who are still among us. Listen to them as they speak to us through writings such as the one that I will share with you now, entitled Afro Mother, written by an anonymous black woman, but oh so appropriate. Children, I come back today to tell the story of the long, hard way I had to fight. I had to know in order that the race might live and grow. Look at my face, dark as the night, yet shining from within with love's pure light. Children sold away from me, husbands sold too. No love, no rest, no respect was I due. But now, through my children, my dreams can come true. It all depends upon what you do. Oh, my dark children out there, don't you forget my pain, my despair. But march ever onward, tearing down bars. Reach for the sun, the moon, and the stars. And I will be with you till no white brother dare put down the children of the Afro mother. Thank you.